The headlines, tensions flare up as Israeli forces break into Al-Aqsa Mosque and make way for settlers to enter the holy site. A report says the United States has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainian armed forces kill several Russian generals. And voters across the UK head to the polls to elect their new local representatives, with a recent survey predicting huge losses for the Conservative Party. Hello and welcome, everybody. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for settlers to enter the holy site in occupied Al-Quds City. A number of Palestinians were injured as Israeli forces fired rubber bullets and tear gas. Israeli troops have on various occasions attacked Palestinians at Al-Aqsa over the past several weeks. That comes despite repeated warnings by Palestinians urging the regime to stop desecrating the holy site. Resistance movement Hamas has reacted to the latest Israeli attack, calling it a serious escalation and direct provocation. Islamic Jihad also said all those gathering at Al-Aqsa to defend it are supported by resistance groups. The Fatah party reacted as well. It promised a firm response to occupiers and called on all Palestinians to converge on Al-Aqsa. We've reached out to our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, Mona Kandil, to get more details about the latest Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex this morning under the protection of Israeli forces, of course, while hundreds of Palestinian Muslim worshippers were inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex in order to prevent this raid by the settlers. However, they were locked down in the Qibli Mosque and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as the complex of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and Israeli forces opened rubber-coated bullets towards them and fired the stun grenades and tear gas canisters in order to force them out of the Muslim holy site and allow the settlers to enter. This is something that is very provocative and considered as desecration of the Muslim holy site, is that we are receiving now settlers held and raised the Israeli flag inside the complex of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians are saying today they don't want to hear more condemnations. What they really want is actions on ground. They want the international community to move to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime.
Historian and journalist Breck Yonker says some Muslim countries have unfortunately been enticed by Israeli money in recent years and ignored the Palestinian cause.
More and more Arab League countries specifically, and unfortunately Muslim countries in general, there are more and more of these regimes, of these governments that have been enticed by the prospect of basically Zionist funds, Zionist money, and the direct material and financial benefits of doing business with the Zionist entity and of recognizing the Zionist entity, and have de facto been bribed out of supporting the Palestinian cause. Now, honesty requires us to admit that a lot of these countries have only been really supporting Palestine in words and not in deeds for already a long time. Specifically, of course, some of the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Bahrain, even if they, until a few years ago, were to support Palestine by word of mouth, they never really did anything to support them. But now we see that since 2020, specifically, some of these countries, some of these governments have openly gone over to the other side and have started blatantly collaborating with the Zionist entity. And that's specifically the case in the UAE and in Bahrain and in countries like Morocco as well. And this is a very, very deplorable situation, because indeed these people, these leaders, these rulers still claim to be self-professed Muslims. And as such, when an attack is taking place against the sanctuary, against the Al-Aqsa compound, this is an attack against all of Islam and an attack against all Muslims worldwide.
Administrative detention is an illegal practice that Israel uses extensively and routinely, told Palestinians. The incarceration has no time limit, and the charges, if any, are never disclosed. The number of Palestinians held under this measure has hit a record high since 2016, but the international community is keeping silent on administrative detention, as it does with the other apartheid practices of the Tel Aviv regime. And this is seen as a green light for Israel to continue its illegal occupation and violation of Palestinians' rights.
An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court.
In the past several weeks, we've seen an escalation in ongoing Zionist attacks, invasions of Al-Aqsa Mosque and many areas in Jerusalem. We've seen repeated invasions of Jenin. We've seen ongoing attacks on demonstrations, on Palestinians defending their land. And that's really in Palestine from the river to the sea. And in many of these cases, these attacks have been accompanied by the mass detention and arrests of Palestinians.
The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
And even though the Israeli occupation's illegitimate military courts convict Palestinians over 99% of the time, they don't even have to do that. Instead, simply by issuing a military order, they can throw any Palestinian behind bars without charge or trial for up to 6 months at a time in a way that's indefinitely renewable. And this is what Israeli administrative...
Currently, more than 2,400 Palestinians are serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts, and close to 1,500 others are being held for questioning, awaiting trial, or are being tried. Meantime, Israel has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years.
According to Israeli rights groups, 2,441 Palestinians are currently serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts. A further 1,478 detainees are being held for questioning, have been charged and are awaiting trial, or are currently being tried. Last month, the Palestinian Prisoners Society, or the PPS, said the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. Palestinian authorities say 1,500 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces during the time span beginning at the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September 2000 up to April 2013. That's the equivalent of one Palestinian child killed every 3 days for about 13 years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's quite clear is that the so-called, you know, security domination of the Israeli occupation is very fragile. And in reality, the Palestinian resistance is exposing that on a daily basis. But that resistance is also taking place inside the prisons as well. Every single one of these over 600 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention are currently engaged in a collective boycott of the military courts to demand that this illegal system, an illegitimate system, come to an immediate end.
The Palestinian Prisoners Center for Studies, or the PCBS, said in a report in September last year that Israeli authorities had clearly escalated targeting Palestinian children. Systematic torture, harassment, and repression are all examples of the fashion in which the Israeli prison authorities treat Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli prison service keeps the prisoners under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Geneva Convention. Israel has for years held Palestinians in overcrowded prisons with poor hygiene standards.
The family of Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri, currently facing trial in Sweden, has faced daily abuse and harassment from supporters of an anti-Iran terrorist group while attending court sessions in Sweden. Nouri is accused of human rights abuses. His family denies all allegations and says he has been mistreated in custody in Sweden. Robert Carter reports.
The family of an Iranian citizen on trial in Sweden has released shocking allegations of mistreatment as they continue to fight a lengthy legal battle for his release. Hamid Nouri was arrested at Stockholm Airport in 2019. Charges brought against him include human rights abuses against prisoners dating back to 1988. Nouri's wife told Press TV that he'd been held in solitary confinement, physically assaulted by prison staff, and subjected to mental torture. Nouri and his family deny all allegations. His detention has been branded illegal by Tehran.
Not only has the trial been condemned by Iranian authorities as unlawful, but also the treatment of the family of the accused. Shocking footage of Nouri's family being harassed has deepened Iranian anger at the Swedish authorities for their poor handling of the case.
Nouri's family have been in and out of court all week. Every time they arrive, supporters of a notorious anti-Iran terror group, MKO, harass and threaten them. The Swedish authorities are slow to respond. Away from the protesters, V spoke to a local Iranian eyewitness who saw this disgraceful behaviour.
It was just really, really sad for me to see an old woman walking up to the stairs to the court and hearing a bunch of words, which actually I'm ashamed even to think about it, not even bring it to my mouth, to even think about it. But this group are known, as I said. We know those people exactly how they are. We know those people from the time which they was killing Iranian soldiers during the war with Iraq. We know those people when they was, I would love to say, leaking Saudi regime's shoes for getting a bunch of dollar or money or whatever, or support from a terrorist regime, as American regime. I really would like to know what's going on for about Sweden, actually. Sweden, a country which always talk about human rights and freedom and democracy, now are supporting and making a favor and show for a group which they have been in years in a terrorist list for whole world, international terrorist list.
The accusations against Nouri are mostly taken from members of this same group. The MKO has been accused of fabricating atrocities multiple times, again raising questions about the credibility of the prosecution, who wished to see Nouri sentenced to life. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Reports indicate that intelligence provided by the United States has helped the Ukrainian military target Russian generals during the Ukraine war. Nearly a dozen Russian generals have been killed since the war began on February 24th. That's according to the New York Times, citing multiple senior U.S. officials. The Daily says many of those generals were targeted with the help of U.S. intelligence. The report says other Western intelligence services also provided assistance in that regard. The U.S. National Security Council has denounced the claim as irresponsible. It said the U.S. only provides battlefield intelligence to help the Ukrainians defend their country. Western officials have attributed the Russian generals' deaths to low morale as well as potential communications and logistics issues. A three-day ceasefire in the Russian-held city of Mariupol, southern Ukraine, has come into effect. The truce began at 500 GMT on Thursday. It was announced by Russia a day earlier. A humanitarian corridor is also open to evacuate civilians from the site of the Azovstal steel plant. Moscow says civilians sheltering there are allowed to travel to Russia or Ukraine-controlled territory. The plant is the last stronghold of Ukrainian forces in the port city of Mariupol. Russia took control of the city last month. Lawmakers warn of dire social consequences for EU citizens after the European Commission proposes to ban Russian oil imports. The 27-nation EU is already enduring record high inflation and energy prices. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Hundreds of civil servants inside the European Commission are working on a sixth round of sanctions against Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine. More Russian individuals, banks and media outlets are being targeted. There is also a proposal to completely stop the importation of Russian oil into the 27-country EU. Legislators say the measures will not only hurt Russia.
They will also affect the lives of European citizens with a direct impact on their homes, their jobs, their wallets.
A debate on Wednesday in the European Parliament heard that inflation in the EU is eating up wages and pensions. Apparently 36 million people in the bloc are unable to sufficiently heat their homes.
We should not talk about energy poverty anymore. We are talking about actual poverty. People who cannot pay their bills anymore. And therefore, my proposal is to organise a social summit.
The new social crisis and Ukrainian refugee crisis are placing additional pressures on EU health systems, including mental health services. Those working in the sector say there is not enough financial support from governments.
I have a lot of colleagues, they are leaving, they don't want to work as a nurse anymore because the pressure is too high. And because if you have a lot of people inside the houses that cannot pay the rent, they cannot afford to pay food, they cannot pay the gas and electricity, of course, they are going to have mental issues.
Pope Francis says NATO's, quote, barking at Russia's door may have caused the conflict in Ukraine. Some EU lawmakers agree and suggest Washington is mostly to blame.
The US needs the war to reinforce the unipolar power, while Ukraine, the people of Europe, and hundreds of millions in the global south will pay the price.
The European Commission's latest sanctions on Russia are presently just proposals.
Ban all Russian oil.
Hungary and Slovakia look set to veto the oil ban. There is growing concern surrounding how the Kremlin might respond to such a ban.
That's because Russia's gas is even more important to the EU's economy than its oil. Economists say if Moscow was to switch off the gas immediately, it would be game over for the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, members of Congress involved in an attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election have refused to testify voluntarily before June's public hearings. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled Capital Attack Panel Set to Subpoena Trump Allies, Republican Kinzinger says. The House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the U.S. Capitol will decide in the next week or two whether to issue subpoenas trying to force Republican lawmakers to testify about Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election. One of two Republicans on the House panel said on Sunday, 1st of May. "If that takes a subpoena, it takes a subpoena," Adam Kinziger, one of the Republicans on the House panel, said. The Illinois congressman also told CBS's Face the Nation program that public hearings planned for June will aim to lay the whole story out in front of the American people, because ultimately they have to be the judge of Donald Trump's attempt to hold on to power. Adam Kinziger and nine other House Republicans voted to impeach Donald Trump over the Capitol attack, which a bipartisan Senate committee linked to seven deaths. But Senate Republicans stayed loyal, acquitting Donald Trump, and Adam Kinziger is one of four anti-Trump House Republicans who have since announced their retirement. Kinziger and Liz Cheney of Wyoming are the only Republicans on the 6th of January House panel. The June hearings, Adam Kinziger said, will involve laying out what led to 6th of January, the lies after the election, fundraising, the 187 minutes the president basically sat in the Oval Office as the Capitol was attacked, and the response by the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon. "It's important for us to be able to put that in front of the American people, because ultimately they have to be the judge." The U.S. Department of Justice will make decisions based on information, but the American people have to take the work we've done and decide what they want to do with it or what they want to believe. Majorities of Republicans in Congress and in public opinion polls believe or choose to support and repeat Donald Trump's lie that Joe Biden stole the presidency via electoral fraud. Prominent Trump supporters in Congress who have advanced that lie and were involved in attempts to overturn the election before 6th of January have refused to speak to the House committee. "I won't say who I think we need to talk to yet," Adam Kinziger said. "I mean, I think everybody needs to come and talk to us. We've requested information from various members. In terms of whether we move forward with a subpoena, it's going to be both a strategic tactical decision and a question of whether or not we can do that and get the information in time. Decisions we make every day." Adam Kinziger added, "I think ultimately, whatever we can do to get that information, I think if that takes a subpoena, it takes a subpoena. But I think that the key is, regardless of even what some members of Congress are going to tell us, we know a lot of information. We're going deeper with richer and more detail to show the American people." Adam Kinziger said he would love to see Mike Pence, Donald Trump's vice president, who ultimately refused to reject Electoral College results on 6th of January 2021, testify before the House committee. Adam Kinziger added, "I hope he would do so voluntarily. These are decisions I think that we're going to end up making from a tactical perspective in the next week or two, because we basically pinned down what this hearing schedule is going to look like, the content. And as we go into the full narrative of this thing, I would hope and think that the Vice President, Mike Pence, would want to come in and tell this story, because he did do the right thing on that day. If he doesn't, we have to look at the options we have available to us if there's information we don't already have." We'll be right back. Meanwhile, a lawyer for Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, a far-right Republican congresswoman shown in court filings by the committee to have been in contact with the White House around 6th of January 2021, has claimed she was in fact a victim of the riot. "I'd love to ask her a few questions," Adam Kinzinger said. "We know some things. I won't confirm or deny the text messages, of course, but let me just say this. For Marjorie Taylor Greene to say she's a victim of the 6th of January riot, it's amazing. I mean, she assaulted, I think, a survivor from a school shooting at some point in Washington, D.C. She stood outside a congresswoman's office and yelled through a mail slot and said Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was too scared to come out and confront her. And then, when Marjorie Taylor Greene is confronted, she's all of a sudden a victim and a poor, helpless congresswoman that's just trying to do a job. That's insane. We want the information."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Now this year, inshallah, what we're going to be talking about has been called the transition. Today we'll be beginning, inshallah, with the barzakh. Okay. But before we get into that discussion, we need to ask another fundamental question. The fundamental question that we want to ask ourselves is this really the right topic for now, considering that we are a youth center? Is this a discussion, the hereafter, Nakir and Munkar, the interrogation, right? Is that a discussion for youth? Or is that a discussion where maybe, let's say, the target audience was older? And, I mean, in our own minds, we think closer to death. Maybe for them that discussion would be good. But for us to be talking about those details and what happens and the grave, is that healthy? Is it good to talk about death, to prepare for death in this way? Is it good for our mental health? Will it lead to depression? We need to cover that. So that'll be our first question, and the answer that I'm going to give three reasons why we should be having this discussion. So one of the benefits of the discussion of the hereafter is we don't get so attached to the dunya, and that's what's negative. So that's the first reason why we should be having these discussions. I actually enjoy the blessings of Allah more when I'm not attached. I don't know if you've seen the video footage of the shuhada when they're about to go for a battle. If you see the individuals hugging and embracing one another, they know we're all about to go meet Allah. The love, the tears, the friendships, they're very real when that attachment isn't there. There's no ego. It's easy to fall in love. It's easy to forgive. You're not attached. So that's one. Number two, brothers and sisters, is that Islam is a very practical religion. The second reason why it is good to prepare or to have these discussions. Islam is a very practical religion. And death is a reality. I mean, how many times does Allah have to tell us in the Quran, "Kullu nafsin dha'iqatul maut"?
Right? The example I'm giving you is from, this is not the only time Allah says this. Surah 3 and verse number 185. Every nafs, every soul will taste death. There's nobody who will live forever and ever and never die. No, everybody will taste death. So if that's a reality, right? Because no atheist, no agnostic, nobody can deny that one day it's all over. Either I think you turn into dust or something, but it's all over. Nobody lives forever. What Islam says is something that's a reality, you should prepare for it. Listen to another verse of the Quran. God says this, Surah 62 and verse number 8. قُلْ, he tells the Prophet, say this, إِنَّ الْمَوْتَ الَّذِي تَفِرُّونَ مِنْ, that death that you're running away from, you're trying to escape from, everybody wants to live as long as they can. He says, فَإِنَّهُ مُلَاقِيكُمْ, death will meet you. You're not going to live here forever. So now, if this is a reality that no one lives here forever, eventually we have to go, doesn't it make sense to prepare for a reality? You don't be like, they say there's a bird that if it thinks there's an animal attacking, it'll put its head in the sand and say, you know, inshallah, there is no cat. That doesn't mean that there's no cat. You prepare for it or you don't, but it's going to happen. So this is Islam stands for all things, all challenges. Instead of us, Islam teaching us, well, have a mental breakdown. Say, oh, woe is me. Have a victim mentality. Islam says, prepare for this. Get ready. It's coming. How do we defeat this? How do we work on this? How do we overcome this? Islam's a practical religion. Sitting down, panicking, that doesn't make any sense. Getting ready for it does. Preparing for it does. One of the du'as that we make in the month of Ramadan, we say this, وَالِاسْتِعْدَادُ لِلْمَوْتِ قَبْلَ حُلُولِ الْفَوْتِ. One of the things we ask God for, oh Allah, help me to prepare for death before the opportunity is lost, before it's too late. We have that beautiful hadith from Imam Ali. He says, the rest of your life is priceless. I may have made mistakes up until now. This may have happened. I might not have done all the right things. I'm still breathing. The rest of your life is priceless. So Islam teaches us to prepare for these realities. You used to hear this also. They say that Allama Tabatabai, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Alayh, that great arif, the teacher of teachers, he would be delivering a class to his students, and in the middle of the class, he would stop the class for a second, and he would say that, brothers, we've got eternity in front of us. Eternity. Because, I mean, you don't just die, you don't turn to dust. No, you're going to live somewhere, either hell or paradise, forever and ever and ever and ever. What does eternity even mean? Even if someone lived as long as Nuh, alayhi salam, Prophet Noah, in the Quran it says he lived for 950 years, but that was just his risala. That was just him being a prophet, not his lifespan. He lived longer than that. Even if someone lived 10 times his life, if you compare that to infinity, eternity, that's nothing. So Islam tells us, well, get ready for this eternity that's on its way. Now, one of the beautiful things for you and I to do, right? Because this is going to, when we say get ready, it keeps us motivated. The remembrance of death, knowing where we're going to go. We never feel satisfied that, alhamdulillah, I have enough good deeds. It's enough. I don't need to push. No, actually, as a Muslim, even though you're doing everything for the sake of God, and you're trying and you're motivated, you never feel you have enough when it comes to the hereafter. It's the opposite of how we feel about this world.
When it comes to this world, we do try to be content. Yes, we try and have a good life, but we try and be content with what Allah has given us. But what about with our good deeds? Should I say, Alhamdulillah, I'm praying, I'm fasting, enough for me? You'll find that even Allah's awliya were not like this. The chosen people of Allah. So you and I, brothers and sisters, inshallah, by the right of the Ahlul Bayt and the hope that we have in the Ahlul Bayt is that they will come to our rescue at that time, the time when it's most difficult and when we need them the most. We ask that Allah accept what was said and heard in His way and help us to become the true soldiers of the living Imam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Biden is crushing the Afghan economy by seizing $3.5 billion of its people's money and diverting the other $3.5 billion for a trust fund to benefit the Afghan people. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Austin Alman Ryder. This article is published under the heading Biden's Decision on Frozen Afghanistan Money is Tantamount to Mass Murder. Stay tuned for more. After making the initial decision last summer to withdraw U.S. forces from Afghanistan, the Biden administration announced recently that it intends to split the Afghan central bank's assets, which are held in the possession of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, between the families of 9/11 victims and unspecified efforts for the benefit of the Afghan people. The decision puts Biden on track to cause more death and destruction in Afghanistan than was caused by the 20 years of war that he ended. For months, the administration has been debating how the future of economic relations with the Taliban-controlled Afghanistan will look like. The assets, which were initially frozen when the Taliban seized control of the country in August, are essential for the liquidity and basic functionality of the economy. With the administration's lack of firm commitment to return the assets to the central bank, which American economists who helped design and still help to run say is still independent from the Taliban, the Afghan people will be reliant on humanitarian aid for the foreseeable future. Already, reports say aid is not enough to prevent the precipitous decline in living conditions the Afghan people are facing. The problem is one of the basic economics. Seizing the central bank funds has brought economic activity to a standstill. People have lost access to money held in banks. Government workers and teachers are going without paychecks. Importers have no access to capital to front the imports. Exporters similarly can't access capital to keep their businesses operating. The currency, the Afghani, has collapsed in value, and inflation is much steeper in Afghanistan than the rest of the world as a result. A White House spokesperson said the administration would create a trust fund to benefit the Afghan people in a variety of ways. In the last few months, as House Democrats squabbled over the wording of letters and senators balked at questions about America's responsibility for the crisis, the situation on the ground in Afghanistan has rapidly devolved. Multiple international organizations have warned that these conditions have pushed nearly 10 million Afghans to the brink of starvation. To survive, people are burning their furniture and other possessions to stay warm or selling them for good. While those 20 years of war, an irregularly long drought, and an especially severe winter have set the stage for the crisis, the proximate cause of the Afghan people's suffering is the seizure of Afghan assets, coupled with sanctions imposed by the United States regime. Members of Congress have been slow in coming to grips with the effects of the Biden administration's policy in the region. In December, Representatives Pramila Jayapal, Cha Garcia, and Sarah Jacobs led over 40 of their colleagues in a letter to the administration that stressed the need for conscientiously but urgently modifying current U.S. policy regarding the freeze of Afghanistan's foreign reserves and ongoing sanctions. Last week, Jayapal, the leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, sponsored an amendment to the America Competes Act on the sanctions, While it did not call for an end to the U.S. sanctions regime, it would have set up the groundwork for Congress to formally study the disastrous effects of economic policies. While House Democrats could have muscled the amendment through their own votes, 44 of them joined every House Republican to block its passage. The Intercept contacted each of those 44 Democrats, and not one of them would provide an on-record explanation for why they opposed studying the devastation Afghans are facing as a result of U.S. policies. With the amendment's failure, legislative action to address the crisis appears stalled for the time being, though Jayapal expressed optimism that the vote could be a precursor to an easing of U.S. restrictions. In an interview with The Intercept recently, she said the caucus felt it was a victory to win the vast majority of Democrats in a vote that, for the first time, really took on the humanitarian effects of these sanctions. Her office did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the Banda administration announcement. A senior Democratic foreign policy aide who was granted anonymity to openly share his thoughts on the Biden administration's action said the policy effectively amounts to mass murder. According to the aide, Biden has had warnings from the UN Secretary General, the International Rescue Committee, and the Red Cross, with a unanimous consensus that the liquidity of the central bank is of paramount importance and no amount of aid can compensate for the destruction of Afghanistan's financial system and the whole macroeconomy. Mark Wisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, agreed with the characterizations of Biden's decision as mass starvation. "Most people don't understand the economics of Biden's devastating decision," he told The Intercept. "If a country doesn't have reserves and it doesn't have a functioning central bank, then there is no amount of aid that's going to come anywhere close to making up for that." Recently, after months of insistence from human rights activists and international non-governmental organizations, Congress finally began to debate the United States' role in the rapidly escalating humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. In a long-overdue hearing in the Senate Foreign Affairs Subcommittee that governs the West Asia, Subcommittee Chair Chris Murphy acknowledged that humanitarian aid alone would not be enough to prevent the rapidly approaching death of thousands of Afghans. Murphy did not directly call for a shift in U.S. policy during the hearing, but he said in an interview with The Intercept that the administration will need to ease sanctions and unfreeze some Afghan assets to mitigate the crisis. "I believe that it's time for us to release the money," he said. Though he reiterated concerns over whether the Afghan central bank can remain truly independent for long under Taliban rule. The only other senator to publicly call for these actions is Senator Bernie Sanders, who tweeted his position on the matter last month. Neither senator's office responded immediately to a request for comment on Biden's decision. Other senators have mostly dismissed questions about America's complicity in a potential Afghan genocide. In interviews with Intercept over the last week, several typically outspoken liberal senators have demurred or rejected the premise of questions about U.S. sanctions regime. Senator Tammy Duckworth, a veteran of America's war in Iraq, denied hearing about the many reports indicating that humanitarian assistance alone will prove insufficient in aiding Afghans. Senator Tammy Baldwin, pointed to the Taliban's prior refusal to allow women and girls to attend school and work to justify Biden's policies, but said she would further study reports confirming that since assuming power in August, the Taliban has continued to allow women to maintain a role in public life. And vocal progressive Senator Mazie Hourneau responded to a question about the devastation wrought by sanctions and frozen assets with a question of her own. We're still talking about Afghanistan? In the subcommittee hearing this week, International Rescue Committee President and CEO David Miliband and International Crisis Group consultant Graeme Smith both gave full-throated condemnations of the international community's financial policies in Afghanistan. Together, the two dispelled the arguments that humanitarian aid could compensate for normalizing economic relations with Afghanistan and rebutted those who point to the cruelties of the groups to justify. Together, the two dispelled the arguments that humanitarian aid could compensate for normalizing economic relations with Afghanistan and rebutted to those who point to the cruelties of the Taliban to justify the cruelties inflicted by the Western countries.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. The day when the war broke out, I am speaking about the sacred defense era, many of us would think that the war would last a week, 10 or 20 days, but it lasted 8 years. From the first day, Imam Rahmatullah Alayhi was confident. Well, some people used to say on that day why such and such decisions was not taken. Well, they were not present and they did not know about the various aspects of the issue. It is possible that some mistakes were done in certain cases at that time. I mean, in general, I did not want to get involved in details, but the general movement was a movement of patience and piety, and eventually things thankfully ended in our victory. The same is true of various other matters. With all these successful experiences that we had in different areas, it would be really an act of oppression to the people, the country, and the revolution if someone decided today to make the people disappointed, to inject a feeling of impasse in the people, and to demolish the people's morale and undermine officials' determination. Of course, our indicators in certain areas are negative.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the economic area, the indicators are not good. All of us agree on this. Previous and future officials and managers and everyone else know that the indicators are not satisfactory in various years until today. Of course, all these are improvable. All these economic problems are definitely correctable by God's favor, and they will be corrected. But the economy is not the only criterion of power, progress, and success. There are other criteria as well. Those criteria must be seen as well. Even in the area of the economy, there are signs of success in different areas, some of which I will mention. First of all, despite the sanctions against our country, the sanctions that existed before and that exist today are unprecedented sanctions. They themselves have acknowledged that from the beginning of history, no country has experienced such sanctions. Our economy did not fail. Despite the predictions made by foreigners saying that Iran would become bankrupt, this did not happen and the economy remained up and running.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.